You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 72, Leviticus 8 and 9. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Well, Mike, I beat you in fantasy this week.
Yeah, you did, and it wasn't really even close.
I had
a terrible week.
Over 65 points, can brag a little bit.
Yeah, you didn't count, though, right?
No, right. Just 65 point something, 4 points, you know.
Yeah.
Who's keeping score?
Yeah, I had a terrible week. I'm in four leagues, and I can't remember the last time I lost every matchup in every league I was in, but it happened this last weekend. So
I really can't say that I feel sorry for you, Mike.
Yeah, so. I know. I'm not shocked.
Well, we're 1-1 because last year you beat me, so I've tied it up. So we're 1-1. So
yeah, well, it's early enough in the season. We might meet again.
That's true. Well, I'm only one game behind you, so.
Yeah, playoffs. I mean, I still have a good record, at least in that league, but and playoffs. Who knows what'll happen there?
All right. Well, nothing goes good with fantasy football as Leviticus, so I'm sure.
Yeah, it was sort of a bloodletting.
Sacrifice on your part.
Nice segue there, yeah. Yeah, it was pretty ugly. So it's just too bad we're not into like skin diseases or something. But that'll come. Today, you know, we're gonna do Leviticus 8-9. I know last time we said 8 to 10, but there's enough here. I just sort of felt bad about, you know, giving 10 sort of a short shrift, so we'll save 10 for next time. But Leviticus 8 and 9 today, and most of the time, even with those two chapters, will be in chapter 8. There is, you know, something in chapter 9 I want to draw attention to. There's a bit of repetition in chapter 9 with the sacrifices of material we've already covered, and that'll happen again in Leviticus as, you know, as we proceed. But 8 and 9, I think, gives us plenty to talk about. So just for the sake of kind of structure and arrangement, most of Leviticus chapter 8 is really devoted to two events, two ceremonies, and that is the consecration ceremony of the altar and the tabernacle, basically the objects that are most concerned with sacred space and the sacrificial system. So consecrating them, getting them ready, you know, to be used, you know, purging them of impurity so that they can be used. And then also consecrating Aaron, the high priest, and his sons as priests. So basically everything that's relevant to the sacrificial system and every person that's going to be sort of officiating and carrying out the duties, they have to be individually and collectively sanctified or consecrated, again, purged of impurity. And so that's why you get references in these two chapters to some of the offerings, the sacrifices and offerings we've talked about up to this point. So this, in chapter 8, takes place over the period of 7 days. And then in chapter 9, we have an 8-day, there's a ritual on the 8th day, and that is sort of a catch-all ceremony to make sure that the entire newly consecrated tabernacle is ready to go. And then there's this celebration of the entry of God's presence, the glory cloud, the kavod. Kavod is the Hebrew word for cloud that takes up residence in the tabernacle. And so that's an 8th day celebration. So it was on the 8th day that the tabernacle altar itself is used for the first time in the performance of a sacrificial ritual. Prior to this, you know, the previous 7 days, there are animals being slain and then blood, you know, sprinkled on the altar itself to purge it of impurity, to ready it for use. But its actual first use is only in chapter 9. So that's basically what the two chapters cover. And, you know, the logic is when you welcome the presence of God into the tabernacle, you have to be extremely careful that everything and everybody has been purged, you know, from impurity so that the presence of God is not polluted, again, if we can use these terms. And so the priests and the people, again, on these occasions, they're going to be offering the offerings, that sacrifices that need to be offered, again, to make sure that everything's ready and set to go that we've sort of talked about prior. So after all that's done, then you get chapter 10, which again, we're going to reserve, you know, for next time, the next episode. Chapter 10 is the chapter where you get, Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, they're struck down by God for offering, quote, strange fire. And the whole point of what happens there in chapter 10 really needs to be set against the backdrop of 8 and 9, because they are a living and you know, basically a dead object lesson as to the seriousness of keeping everything the way it should be and observing all these rules about being fit, you know, to enter sacred space and to offer what needs to be offered in the proper way at the proper time and all that sort of stuff. So Aaron loses two sons basically to make the point that, hey, God's actually serious about this. You're supposed to learn these lessons about sacred space and approaching God and making sure that God's purity is never polluted and all that sort of thing. So we'll leave chapter 10 for next time, but I think it's worth pointing out here that that needs to be understood against the backdrop of these earlier two chapters. The consecration ceremonies for the people and the things that are going to be used in the whole system. Now, we're going to jump into chapter 8 here. So let me just go to Leviticus 8, because I'm not going to be reading through the entirety of both chapters, but a few sections, and then just stopping along the way and commenting about a few things that are, again, I think are interesting. So in chapter 8, we read, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take Aaron and his sons with him, and the garments and the anointing oil, and the bull of the sin offering, and the two rams, and the basket of unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and the congregation was assembled at the entrance of the tent of meeting." Now, there's a lot of people here, so, you know, it's worth commenting about, well, how do you get them all at the entrance of the tent of meeting? What does that mean? Well, again, rather than overly literalize this, the actual place of assembly for the people was the outer section of the courtyard, not like, it's not that everybody had to be right in front of the tent, because there just isn't space for that. But we're going to talk a little bit about the logistics of sacred space in this episode, because there are just some things that happen basically because, you know, the system is what it is because you have to account, it has to serve the whole population of the Israelite nation, but yet there's this limited space when you're talking about the tabernacle. So again, how does that work? There are some concessions that have to be made and some rules that have to be put into place. But in this instance, when the chapter starts out, they're basically in the courtyard area. And according to the procedures given in Leviticus, it was forbidden for anybody except priests. And again, the priests are about to be consecrated, but no one but priests could advance beyond the altar of burnt offerings. Again, I can't visually give you a depiction here in the podcast of the layout of the tabernacle, but you might want to pull one up online or something like that, just so that you can see what I'm talking about here. But if you were not a priest, you could not advance beyond the altar of burnt offerings. That was off limits. Again, sacred space, that could only be occupied by someone Yahweh had chosen to serve him in that capacity. And then that person had to do the right set of offerings and that we've talked about up to this point so that sacred space was not polluted or profaned by that person. So basically, it was an area, the courtyard is about halfway between the outer gate and the entrance to the tabernacle proper. And again, without getting into it, because we're not doing Exodus. If we were doing a podcast on Exodus 25 through 40, we could talk about how the colors, how the materials used to construct the tent proper, and then the sections of the tent actually denoted gradations of sanctity. For instance, in terms of the metals, there would be, you know, metals progressing all the way up to gold, you know, fine gold that was reserved for the innermost part of again, the Holy of Holies. Well, the higher gradation of metals as you moved into the complex was, again, a sign. It's a symbol of sanctity, a symbol of importance or value. The closer you got to the actual presence of God, the more expensive, you know, the more valuable the material was. Again, these were just object lessons. It's not like God is, you know, God's not Donald Trump here. That isn't the point. You know, look at, you know, all the expensive stuff God has, and God owns it. He owns everything. So there's no point to that. But the point is that the materials that were used were supposed to inform the person working in there. And again, the people, as they know what's going on, they see the thing constructed, they know what it's made of. And then of course, they teach people that too, teach their children these sorts of things, that the lesson was the presence of God was something so significant, so important, that you had to use materials that were again, increasing in value as you move toward him. So I think that's sufficient. That's all we really need to say about that, because, again, we're not in Exodus 25 through 40. It was still an important teaching point. So I thought maybe we should, I wanted to say something about that, but I don't want to get distracted by it either. So in verse 5, Moses says to the congregation, this is the thing that the Lord has commanded to be done. So Moses is going to explain what's going to go on. And verse 6 says, Moses brought Aaron and his sons and washed them with water. Now, again, this is a very familiar act done really with any priestly system in the ancient Near East, using water, again, as a symbolic gesture, a symbolic act of removing impurity. Because, again, just in the language of life experience, this is how you cleaned things. I mean, they don't have the fancy chemicals we have today. If you wanted to clean something, you used water. So that's what they're doing here. And it's kind of interesting. If you look at the usage in the Hebrew Bible of the verb used here, to wash, rakats, is the lemma here. It typically, it really basically always refers to the washing of the hands and the feet. So what we have here is Aaron and his sons are brought there. Their hands and their feet are washed. You'll notice there's no mention in that verse. Moses brought Aaron and his sons, washed them with water. Then he puts the coat on him, ties the sash around the waist. That's when you get the description of what the high priest is wearing. The ephod, the band around the waist, the breastplate, the Urim and the Thummim. We're going to talk about all this stuff a little bit today. The turban on the head, all that stuff. There's no mention of sandals. So it's kind of curious. Again, I just think it's worth pointing out that rachatz is when you wash the hands and the feet, because those are the two things that matter in sacred space. The hands matter because they're going to touch objects that have been, you know, quote, made holy or sanctified to the Lord. We've talked about some of these things already in previous episodes. So the act of washing the hand, because the hand is what is going to be touching objects, the hands need to be purified. So this was a ritual act that denoted, okay, this person now is fit to touch holy objects, because he's undertaken this ritual. The feet were important because you're going to walk on holy ground. This is actually consistent with other passages like Exodus 3, the burning bush, Joshua 5, the captain of the Lord's host, when they're told, take off your sandals because you're standing on holy ground. The priests actually did what they did barefoot, and their feet were washed, again, in a ritual act to denote that, okay, now your feet have been purged of impurity and you can walk on sacred space. So the priests would go around barefoot, doing whatever they needed to do, and their feet and their hands were cleansed, again, making them fit to do whatever it was they needed to do. So let's read verses 7 to 9 to get the full description here of what the priest is wearing. I'm not going to talk about every element, because there are some that are just more interesting than others. But verse 7, we see that Moses put the coat on him, Aaron, and tied the sash around his waist, clothed him with the robe, put the ephod on him, and tied the skillfully woven band of the ephod around him, binding it to him with the band. And he placed the breastpiece on him, and in the breastpiece he put the Urim and the Thummim. And he set the turban on his head, and on the turban in front he set the golden plate, the holy crown, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, this stuff is described in Exodus 28, Exodus 29, again, the high priestly garments and the garments for the other priests as well. But I just wanted to say a few things about some of these things, especially the Urim and the Thummim, because that I get questions about this all the time. And it's kind of an interesting topic because it deals with divination and whatnot. But the ephod, I think, is the ephod, the Urim, and the Thummim are the most interesting objects here. So the high priest has to wear a linen tunic, and that gets tied with a sash, and then he has to put a robe on top of that. And then the ephod was worn over all that. And the robe that the ephod fits over, according to Exodus 28, was made of purple wool, and it had golden bells attached to it. Between each bell, there was a pomegranate. That's Exodus 28, 34, and Exodus 39, 26. And I think that's interesting because there's this, you don't actually see this in the Old Testament, but there are Second Temple sources and rabbinic sources. I wanted to say rabbinic speculations about why the bells were there and what purpose they served. And I think there is a practical possibility here. Let's just call it a possibility, because you don't actually have an example of this historically, either in the Old Testament or not. But you'll actually read of speculations like when the high priest, especially at the Day of Atonement, when he actually went in and stood before the Ark of the Covenant, he entered the most holy place. Since he's the one wearing the bells here, this robe that has the bells, sewn at the bottom, that that was so that people could hear that he was moving around and that he was still alive. And you'll read, again, rabbinic sort of speculations about tying a rope around his leg because, again, someone figured out, well, if God kills him, if he does something wrong, if he's impure and God strikes him down, how do we get him out? And so you tie a rope around the leg, and if the bells stop, you know, ringing, then there might be a problem. Okay, there might be trouble, that sort of thing. Again, that never actually, there's no actual instance of that either in the Old Testament or, again, other ancient sources. But you will read about this kind of speculation, kind of, you know, hey, maybe we should do this, or someone will allude to the fact that it was done, but nothing ever happened. Again, how do you validate that historically? Well, I guess you can't in one sense, but again, just in terms of a practical sort of solution to, you know, a problem that could come up in somebody's mind. Well, you know, because of Nadab and Abihu, like in Leviticus 10, what if this happens to the high priest? What, how do we get him out? We can't just go in there. And if he's in the Holy of Holies, even the priests, you know, no priest is going to say, yeah, I'll go in and get him, because he could get struck dead too. So again, as a practical consideration, yeah, maybe this is why the bells were there. Maybe they did tie a rope around his ankle or something. Again, you'll see that referenced, you'll see this problem alluded to, but you don't actually have an incident of it. But it's kind of interesting. The ephod itself I find interesting because it's made of wool. Again, if you go back to Exodus, the chapters that describe its constitution, it's made of wool and linen, and it has gold threads woven into the fabric. And so much so that it has a golden appearance. Now, the reason I mention this, you know, the sort of the amount of gold, I'm hinting at something here, is that elsewhere in the Old Testament, you will see people like David call for the ephod to be brought to them. You'll see Gideon. Okay, Gideon, quote, sets up an ephod in Judges 8, verse 7 in his hometown. I mean, he either makes a replica of this, or, you know, it has something to do with divination, with asking God questions for the will of God and that sort of thing. Because in the high priest's ephod, you know, you had the Urim and the Thummim on this pouch that was on the breastpiece, and that's what the high priest would use again to get knowledge from God. So there are other passages that either that specific ephod was used again by a high priest or some priest to ask questions of God, or you have somebody like Gideon who might have sort of made his own. And the question is, well, that's just kind of odd. Why are you asking for like a garment to be brought up? And how do you, quote, set up a garment? Well, this has led to some speculation. Some people say, well, maybe they're just using the term ephod for a statue, like Gideon made a statue or an idol or something, because Gideon, by this time in Judges 8, really isn't a good guy. Maybe that's what's going on. Others suggest, well, maybe they made a statue and they clothed it. They put clothes on it so that it would look like the high priest. And then that was brought out, something like that. There's another possibility here. If there was enough gold in this thing, and if it was the actual ephod, or again, an exact replica, there is the possibility that it could have stood on its own. It could have supported its own weight because of the gold in it, and it would have sort of held the fabric firm, and you could move it around and stand it erect. Who knows? I mean, we're not specifically told. It's just that the same term, the ephod, is used in these contexts, especially Gideon, there's the issue with the Levite later in the book of Judges, whose name is Micah. Again, he's not really the high priest, but yet he has this ephod and he uses it. So you have these situations where they're using something, and something is moved around, something is brought to them and put back that has something to do with the way the actual ephod functioned. Now, the high priest would have been wearing this thing, and again, would have had the Urim and Thummim inside of it. So there's some apparent attempt to either use that actual object or to make something like it to use for divination, to get knowledge, you know, from God on the part of other people. So again, it's speculation. We're not specifically told, but, you know, those are the possibilities. You know, while we're at it, let's talk a little bit about the Urim and the Thummim. That's mentioned in verse 8. And this is really, I don't know, somebody should just make a Twilight Zone episode out of the Urim and the Thummim, because there's just all sorts of interesting possibilities here. So we have in verse 8, you know, Moses places the breastpiece on Aaron, and in the breastpiece he puts the Urim and the Thummim. So what are these things? Again, there's two of them. There are these two objects. What are they? Now, the meanings of Urim and Thummim, even that's not completely clear. They're apparently stone objects. And the question is, there's a number of questions about them, but the first question is, what shape were they in? Were they flat or fairly flat stones, like on one side? And that question is raised because in Mesopotamia, there are similar objects used to cast lots. Now, you say, well, why are we talking about casting lots with the Urim and the Thummim? Because in passages like 1 Samuel 14, where the Urim and the Thummim are brought out, you know, this is the episode where Saul, you know, makes this stupid vow about nobody can eat anything until this battle's won. And of course, Jonathan, his son, doesn't hear it. And Saul's like, anybody who eats anything is going to be put to death. And so Jonathan's the hero of the battle, but he has some honey out in the battlefield because he was exhausted. And he comes back, and then this is found out. And so Saul is put in the awkward position of having to execute the guy responsible for winning the battle. And of course, they don't do that. The people basically protect Jonathan and protest that the whole thing of just basically this was a dumb thing to say. But while Saul is trying to figure out what's going on here, who's the guilty party, because he hears about this, they bring out the Urim and the Thummim, and it's actually said that they are cast, they are thrown down in the Hebrew text. And so the speculation is that, well, maybe they were flat on one side, and so they would land either one side or the other. Because again, you have this casting lot terminology associated with the Urim and the Thummim. Now, if that's the case, if the Urim and the Thummim were like flat stones where they could be on one side or the other, in other words, they couldn't stand on edge if you threw them, then the view is that, well, there must have been something on them that elicited either a yes or a no response, a positive or a negative response. And so some scholars believe that the Urim and the Thummim were designed specifically for yes and no questions of God. Now, if that's the case, again, if that's the case, the word thumim in Hebrew, tumim, has a fairly apparent meaning because it would be from the Hebrew adjective tam, which means to be complete or to be innocent. Urim, therefore, if we have this polar oppositional idea, Urim, which is Aleph, Resh, and then the M at the end is the plural, could come from the Hebrew lemma Arar, Aleph, Resh, Resh, which means to curse. So you could have on the face of one side of the stone the word for curse, and on the other side of the stone the word for innocent, which would sort of by extension be yes and no. Or you'd have to be careful about, you know, what question you were asking, and then you threw them. And so the idea was whichever side comes up, that's what God is telling us, cursed or innocent, yes or no. So you'd have to think about the way you wanted to ask the question. Now, again, this is just a theory. And it obviously, if you're tracking with me, it raises the question, well, what happened if you throw the two things down and then opposite sides both show up? You have the yes and the no both show. Then what do you do? There's actually an instance in the Septuagint that gives us a little glimpse into this, that there might be something to this theory. So I'm going to read from, it's either Milgram or Levine, I can't remember which, at this point, but one of them says, there's a classic instance of the use of the Urim and Thummim preserved in 1 Samuel 14, again, which I've already alluded to. King Saul's orders had been disobeyed. In order to discover the guilty parties, he has recourse to the oracular inquiry of God. So, hoping that his son Jonathan will not be identified. I mean, when it gets sort of down where Jonathan's a possibility, that the Septuagint version of this story has Saul saying to the Lord, show the Thummim. In other words, show the Tom side, show the innocent side. And that, because that's going to clear Jonathan. So in the Septuagint, you get this statement by Saul. He says, Saul then said to the Lord, the God of Israel, why have you not responded to your servant today? If this inquiry is due to my son Jonathan or to me, O Lord God of Israel, show Urim. You know, if one of us is guilty, show the cursed side. And if you say it was due to your people Israel, show the Tamim. Then we're both cleared. And then, of course, you know, it turns up, you know, to be Jonathan. Well, look at what Saul says. Why have you not responded to your servant? Now, this is in the Septuagint. You're not going to get it in the Masoretic text. So the speculation here is because Saul asks for the Thummim side. So some scholars will say, look, here's an indication that on one side was innocent, other side was cursed. Yes, no, kind of questions. And it, since Saul has to say, why haven't you answered? The speculation is that he had thrown them a number of times and you got one of each show up and Saul's getting a little frustrated. You know, so he's like, oh, come on, you know, give us an answer here. And then, of course, it turns out to be something against him. Again, that's how the Septuagint has it. So the Septuagint actually adds information that you don't get in the traditional Masoretic text. But it sort of goes hand in hand with this idea that the Urim and the Thummim were stones that were flat so that you would get one or the other when you threw them out, when you cast them. Kind of like flipping a coin, you know, heads or tails, that sort of thing. So again, maybe that's the case. Maybe it isn't. You know, who knows? There are some problems with it, even though it sort of works or it sort of could work. Milgram points out that there are some issues here. There are some problems. So he says, even if the Septuagint represents the correct story and the correct text, the theory would not allow for an inconclusive answer. You'd have to keep throwing the things, which just kind of, you know, to Milgram just doesn't feel right. He says it also wouldn't explain the plural forms of Urim and Thummim. Why not just have Ur or Arar, curse, and Tam, you know, for innocent? Why the plural? Why the plural word? That doesn't make any sense if it's just a yes or no possibility. And Milgram adds, above all, it would not explain how the oracle was able to give more than yes and no answers. Because that does happen. Okay, in Judges 1:1 and 2, Judges 1, Judges 18, 1 Samuel 10, right around verse 22, 2 Samuel 2, the beginning of the chapter, and then 2 Samuel 5, you have incidents that involve David, Saul, David a couple times actually, and then of course the people of Israel in the beginning of Judges, Judges 18 would be the other Levite. Again, you have them inquiring of God, quote unquote. Now some of these, in fact, I think maybe all of them, don't actually say that the Urim and the Thummim were brought out and when the question was asked, but the same formulaic language, to inquire of God, sha'al, to ask of God, that is used with the Urim and the Thummim episodes, shows up in these instances, and the answers to the questions are just beyond yes and no possibilities. You actually get sort of full answers. For instance, at the one in 2 Samuel 5, David inquired of the Lord. This is 2 Samuel 5, 23, 24. And the Lord answered, do not go up, but circle behind them and confront them at the bacah trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the bacah trees, then go into action, for the Lord will be going in front of you to attack the Philistine forces. That is way beyond yes, go up. No, don't go up. So how in the world were the Urim and the Thummim, if they're only, you know, if it's a stone with two flat sides and one's yes, one's no, one's cursed, one's innocent, how in the world do you get a fully developed answer like that? And again, these other passages have similar things in them that are just more fully developed answers. How do you get that with just a yes or no possibility, with a two-sided Urim and the Thummim? So again, Milgram's not the only one to point this out, that you've got kind of a problem here. How do you, it just doesn't work. In these instances, again, under the assumption that to inquire of the Lord means to go get the priest, bring the ephod, get out the Urim and the Thummim and cast those babies down, and then, you know, we'll find out what God wants us to do. So that's the assumption. Now, this has led to a second possibility, or at least a second theory. Some scholars have argued, I'm going to throw in a third too, because it's one I heard in Bible college that always makes me chuckle, but that's a freebie. The second serious one is that some scholars argue that the Urim and the Thummim were not flat, that they were actually sort of square-shaped, like dice. Okay, they had, you know, more than two sides. They had multiple sides. And that on those sides were the letters, the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, or I should say, maybe not all 22, but maybe most of them or something like that. Here's the logic. Since Hebrew is a Semitic language, and most words, most lemmas, lemma is the basic dictionary spelling of a word. Like if you wanted to look up the word running in an English dictionary, you won't find running. You'll find run, though. You'll find the base form of the word. In Hebrew, the base form of words are typically, overwhelmingly spelled with only three consonants. It's a tri-radical language, a tri-literal language. And so most of the words in the language are going to only have three letters And so you could fit enough of the alphabet on a multi-sided object, okay, to account for a lot of the vocabulary in Hebrew. And that's the theory. You might think, well, that's just sounds kind of weird. Well, wait till you hear number three. If let's just use dice. Dice we use now as an illustration have six sides. So let's say you had two of these. You have 12 sides, and you put 12 letters of the Hebrew alphabet on. I mean, you're missing 10. But let's just say you put 12, maybe like the beginning consonant for each tribe or something like that. And now you got two dice, and you whatever two sides, when you throw the things, they land face up. You know, okay, you take those two, and then maybe you throw another one, and then you get your third consonant, and now you've got your first word. Or you keep throwing them, and you just write out the consonants, and then it's the priest's job to take all those letters and figure out what God's trying to say, you know, which ones sort of make words. Again, it's kind of an odd theory, but this is a theory that's actually talked about in the literature. If the priest couldn't make sense of it, then that would be interpreted as God's silence. Okay. So again, on the surface, it sounds like it has a little bit of logic to it, because a lot of people just don't prefer the two-sided option because you get answers that are really kind of long, kind of complicated. Again, who knows? Now, if you think that's bizarre, here's the third theory I'll throw in. I heard this in Bible college, and again, it always makes me chuckle. The third suggestion is that the Urim and the Thummim weren't used in those instances that give longer answers. What was used was the breast piece, because that's also part of the ephod. And on the breast piece, you'll recall, you had these 12 stones, and on the stones were written the names of the tribes of Israel. And so the theory here is that when you asked God a question that involved more than a yes or no answer, that the stones, I can't help it, I'm chuckling here. We used to call this the blinking light theory in Bible college. The stones would light up, and then the priest would write down the consonants on that stone. And again, whatever stones lit up, those are the ones you'd write down, and then you have to figure out what the message is. Okay, do you like that? If you like that better than the other two, congratulations. Again, nobody really knows precisely what the Urim and the Thummim were and how this worked. The only real indication you get is 1 Samuel 14 when they are cast. Okay, so there must have been some sort of casting act going on. There you have it. Okay, so every time someone inquires of the Lord, do we assume it's Urim and the Thummim when they're not actually mentioned? Some say yes, some say no. Those who say no say maybe it was the breast pieces. Or the ephod, you know, itself, or who knows what's going on. I mean, that's the honest answer. You can come up with ideas as to how this might have worked. And for yes and no questions, it works kind of well. But for the ones that go beyond yes and no, who knows? Again, I've just given you the speculation. So if you find any of those entertaining, you know, good. Because like I said, years after I heard that the blinking light theory, I still love it. Just makes me chuckle every time. Let's go to verse 9, the headdress. I want to say something about this. You have, you know, the high priest wearing a turban. And in the front, there's this golden plate, the holy crown, as the Lord commanded Moses. And we're told, you know, elsewhere in Exodus that on this plate were engraved the words Kodesh La Adonai, Kodesh La, and then the divine name. It means holy to the Lord or sacred to the Lord, to Yahweh. And this indicated that the high priest himself, you know, was, as a sanctified individual, was the one that, again, could enter the most holy place, and he represented the nation. In Ezekiel 28:38, you have this reference to this idea that the high priest represents the entire nation. I'll just read it to you. It says that the plate, the gold plate, it shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall bear any guilt from the holy things that the people of Israel consecrate as their holy gifts. It shall be regularly on his forehead, that they, not him, that they may be accepted before the Lord. So this just, again, marked visually that the high priest was the representative of the entire people. And this was especially seen, again, on the Day of Atonement, because he's the only one who could go into the most holy place before the Ark of the Covenant. Again, most listeners are going to be familiar with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement ceremony, at least in that respect. So I think this is kind of interesting because it's a very sort of literal bearing of the sacred name. One individual actually wears the name. He bears the name of Yahweh. But do you realize that in a more abstract sense, every Israelite bore the name. Every Israelite carried the name in an abstract sense. You say, what are you talking about? Well, this is something that often isn't realized. But in Exodus 20, okay, this is the Ten Commandments. Verse 7 says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. The word take there, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, is nasa. It's the same word for to lift up or carry or bear. So the command doesn't actually refer to verbal swearing, okay? It refers to bearing the name not in vain, not emptily, not uselessly, not worthlessly. And what does bearing the name mean? Well, bearing the name means you are sort of owned by God. You are God's people. He is the name. Okay, think back to lots of the things I've done on the blog, the chapters in the Unseen Realm about the name theology of the Old Testament. Every Israelite was warned, do not represent God, the true God. All these other nations, they're doing their own thing with their other gods that God has allotted to them. Deuteronomy 32 worldview. You people, you represent the true God. You bear the name and do not bear it lightly. Don't bear it worthlessly. Don't represent it poorly is the idea. And this idea carries into the New Testament. You know, Paul says to Timothy, let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. You represent Yahweh, Israelite. And Paul's saying you represent Jesus. Christian, okay, Christians, okay, you're called. I mean, the name of the Christ attaches to his followers. This is representation. This is imaging. This is divine imaging, just sort of recast with a different term. Now it's bearing the name. It's the same idea. It's representing God. And interestingly enough, when you get to the book of Revelation, you know, the whole thing about 666, the name of the beast, unbelievers are marked with the name of the beast. They bear that name. And believers and the 144,000 and all that, they are marked with the name of God, the name of Jesus. Again, it's this, again, abstract idea of representation and ownership, imaging and ownership. I mean, that's what was conveyed with this idea with the high priest. With him, it's done explicitly and literally has it, you know, literally engraved on his forehead on this band, this gold band, you know, holy to the Lord, sanctified to the Lord. Remember back in our earlier episodes of the podcast, we talked about what it meant to be consecrated or sanctified. It was something that was set aside for specific and exclusive use by God. And so the high priest is set aside for very specific use, you know, by God in very specific, you know, circumstances and represents the people. But the people themselves in the law are told to not bear the name worthlessly, carelessly. Again, I just think it's a really good object lesson that kind of ties together, or at least advances, that's probably a better way to say it, advances the idea of divine imaging for believers. Because every human images God. Every human is God's representative on some level, on a very broad level. But when it comes to believers, especially post-Babel, post-Deuteronomy 32 worldview, post the time when God disinherits the nations and allots the nations to other gods and allots those gods to the other nations, then imaging God takes on a new meaning. It is alignment with the true God, with Yahweh. It is representing the true God, Yahweh, bearing his name in distinction from and to distinguish you from all other peoples and all other gods. And again, it carries right into the New Testament. So I think it's a really interesting feature here, just a sort of a thing that we see in passing here in Leviticus 8 that's really worth pointing out. In verse 10, Moses takes the anointing oil, anoints the tabernacle and all that was in it, and consecrates them. I want to say something about that a little bit later when we transition into chapter 9. We get down to verses 14 and following. This is the section where the altar is cleansed, where we have the altar atoned for. Again, the altars don't sin. This isn't moral sinning. This is, if you remember back to earlier episodes, this is purging, okay? Purging from impurity, purging from, you know, infection. This is disinfecting things. So you have the Aaron and his sons, the priests, and the altar. Again, this is just how it's done. So in verses 14 on toward the end of the chapter, you have these procedures, the sprinkling, the pouring of the blood, you know, on different objects to disinfect them, to ready them for use. verse 22. That's kind of interesting. This is when the high priest, well, I'll just read it. He presented the ram of ordination. Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. He killed it. Moses took some of its blood, put it on the lobe of Aaron's right ear, the thumb of his right hand, the big toe of his right foot. Then he presented Aaron's sons, and he does the same thing to them. Well, the extremities, the human extremities, again, the ear, the thumb, the toe, the person is literally being purged and purified and sanctified and consecrated from head to foot is the point. Again, we've washed the hands and feet because the hands are going to be working with sacred objects and the feet are going to be walking on holy ground. But now the blood, again, is applied to the priest and Aaron's sons, again, head to foot, basically saying that their entire body now has been disinfected and is now made fit for occupying sacred space. And you get to verse 24, Moses put some of the blood, again, on the sons of Aaron's ears and the toes and all that. And he threw the rest of the blood, against the sides of the altar. Now that's kind of interesting because when the remainder of the blood taken from the ram of ordination, as it's called, is cast on the altar, that is actually an analogy. That act is an analogy to what occurred back in Exodus 24 in the enactment of the Sinai covenant. Now, back then, part of the blood was cast upon the altar, and that represented God as one of the parties of the covenant. And the rest of the blood was sprinkled and cast, flung over the people, who were the other party in the covenant. In the ordination of the priests here, again, it sort of has a dual function. Purifies the priests who represent the people, and also, again, binds them in a covenant relationship. The priest, in this case, to serve God in his tabernacle on sacred space in relation to the carrying out of the law, and when the law is violated, to bring people back into a right standing through the sacrificial system. So again, you have this analogy back to the Sinai ritual in this particular act. Now, one more thing I want to mention here is in chapter 9. The end of chapter 8 starts talking about the tent of meeting, mentions it briefly, and then chapter 9, we pick up with tent of meeting again, and that phrase is going to become important here because there is something about it that I think is interesting. In chapter 9, we get this eighth-day ritual for, again, sanctifying the whole system, essentially the altar and the tabernacle itself, and that happened on the eighth day. Again, tabernacle altar is actually used, and now the whole system basically is now in place after this ritual. It's kind of interesting, at least to me anyway. If you've ever read, this is going to sound like it's really coming out of left field, like it has nothing to do with this, but if you've ever read anything about J.E.D.P., the authorship of the Pentateuch, in the four separate sources, one of the arguments to divide the Pentateuch up into sources is variation in vocabulary. And typically what we associate with that is differences in the divine name, Yahweh versus Elohim. And that was one of the things that led people to speculate, well, why isn't it just one name? Why do we have these two names, Yahweh names and Yahweh and then El names? And that must be two different sources. Then we get J and E, Yehovah and Elohim. But the discussion of differences in vocabulary is actually much bigger than that. And one of the issues is, why do we have a word like tabernacle, Mishkan, again, for the tent? And then we have Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. Why not just have one? Either call it a Mishkan or call it the Ohel Moed. Why do we have two? And again, critics thought, well, that indicates two sources. Well, it's actually, I think, fairly easy to show that that is a misguided understanding, at least with these two terms, Mishkan and Ohel Moed. If you actually do some searching for both of these terms, Mishkan, tabernacle, and Ohel Moed, tent of meeting, you find something interesting. In the case of Mishkan, okay, the tabernacle, that term is used a lot in the book of Exodus, almost 60 times. But in Leviticus, it only occurs 4 times. You say, well, big deal. Well, when you get Mishkan, it begins to be used in Exodus sort of where you'd expect it, from chapter 25 onward, because that's when the tabernacle is being built. And you might ask yourself, well, okay, they build the tabernacle in Exodus 25 through 40. Got that. And so then it's ready to be used. So naturally, we would expect Leviticus, the sacrificial system, to be talking about the tabernacle all the time. But guess what? It doesn't. It uses the term Mishkan, tabernacle, only 4 times in the entire book of Leviticus. Instead, what you get in Leviticus is you get the other phrase, the Ohel Moed. So in 62 occurrences, okay, in terms of, you know, you're sort of a collective between these books of the Tent of Meeting, when it comes to Leviticus, you have a concentration of the Tent of Meeting terminology in Leviticus as opposed to the tabernacle in Exodus. Why? Okay, think about it. Even though you have Tent of Meeting show up in Exodus, that term is basically almost exclusively the term you get in Leviticus, whereas in the other term, it's sort of flipped. What makes the difference? What makes Leviticus different than Exodus 25 through 40? Why does Leviticus favor Tent of Meeting and not tabernacle? The reason is what we just read, Leviticus 8 and here in Leviticus 9. The tabernacle has to be sanctified and the priests have to be sanctified in order for God to meet people there. And so once that happens, the Tent of Meeting, the meeting language, takes over in Leviticus, because now this tabernacle thing that, you know, we were talking about in Exodus, now we're not going to use that terminology. Now we're going to talk about that structure as the place where God meets with his people through the priesthood. So after you get this sanctification ritual, it's sort of reflected in the way that term is used. Again, in the book of Leviticus, it's just, again, it's one of these sort of vocabulary situations that telegraph a certain theological message. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the word tabernacle, but now that it's in place, now that it's been sanctified, now that the system is in place, this is the place where God meets with us. And so, again, it just telegraphs to people what's going on, and of course to readers, telegraphs to us what's going on too. So, to wrap up here, just a few thoughts that I think we can get out of Leviticus 8 and 9. Think about the necessity of the priesthood. Now you say, well, you know, okay, the priests represent the people. Well, wouldn't it be nice, you know, if the people had direct access to God like we do? Well, they don't. Okay, we've talked about this before, and we see now that, you know, frankly, there's sort of a logistic reason for this too. You have to have a priesthood because the tabernacle is only so large, and the amount of sacred space is only so large. You can't just have everybody there. So there's a logistic reason why access to God is restricted to only a handful of people. And again, just think about the way a Jew in Jesus' day would have thought of this. That whole system, that whole necessity, probably a better way to say it, that whole necessity is gone because the same presence that made the space sacred back in Leviticus now dwells in us, and we all have access to God. There is no restriction of sacred space. There's no need for it, either on a spiritual level, a theological level, or a physical level. There's just no need for it. So we have a situation where God dwelled among his people in the Old Testament, but he wasn't in them like we have in the New Testament. That's actually, that whole situation where God wasn't in, you know, indwelling, is going to necessitate the new covenant. Because, you know, without that, you only have, I hate to say it this way, but you only have occasional contact with the presence of God. And even then, it's through the priesthood. And that just isn't going to cut it when it comes to sort of combating human nature, you know, our propensity and our willingness to sin. So part of the new covenant is the coming of the Spirit, and the Spirit takes up residence in the believer. Again, that's not something that was going on. It wasn't common in the Old Testament. You had an entirely different setup. And lastly, think about divine knowledge. And we spent a lot of time on the Urim and the Thummim in this episode. I mean, you had to go through the priests to get answers to a whole variety of questions. Why? Well, there's no Bible. And frankly, there's very little Torah, even if you accept, you know, Mosaic authorship for every word. This is the book of Leviticus. We're here at Sinai. Okay, if you're, again, going with Mosaic authorship, they spend 13 months at Sinai building the tabernacle, getting the clothes for the priest, you know, sanctifying the whole system, and then they take off and go to the promised land after all this ritual stuff is done. They're there for 13 months, and if Moses is busy writing then, you've still only got a very small portion, and even what you have is about the law and about the priest and about the tabernacle and all that. You don't have any information from God, really, to direct you in all sorts of ways. This is why, if you think back to the episode with Moses and Jethro, Moses had to spend his day answering questions. And Jethro says, well, this isn't really isn't a good use of your time. You know, you need to appoint, you know, elders to help you out. And of course, Moses does that. They don't have scripture. They don't have revelation. What that means is they do not have access to divine knowledge. The average person didn't have any of that. Again, it's so much superior in the New Testament context compared to the Old. And we probably never even thought of that particular way, that particular setting for why it's just better now. So we should be thankful. And, you know, frankly, even in light of our Urim and Thummim discussion, even what they did get from the Urim and the Thummim, that had an element of uncertainty. Did we pick the right words right? Did we spell it right? Is it a yes or no? Is it not? I mean, even that, again, was sort of an imperfect process or an imprecise process, or maybe a better way to say it, one that just had this element of uncertainty and subjectivity to it because of the way knowledge was dispensed through the priesthood. It's going to get better with the prophets. God's going to speak to them more often. And he does speak to Moses, but Moses is going to die. He does speak to Joshua. Joshua is going to die. Then we get in the period of Judges and the whole thing, you know, just sort of blows up. And what you're left with is what we just described. Again, a very sort of uncertain process with an element of subjectivity in it to know what God's thinking, to know what he wants us to do. Well, I mean, what we have today is just so much better. So again, we can learn comparative things like that just by paying attention to what's going on in Leviticus 8-9 and looking at them in their context.
Just imagine how much easier it would have been if they just had a magic eight ball.
I know. I thought you were going to say, just imagine how much better it would have been if I could have just asked the Urim and the Thummim who to start last week.
Yeah, that too.
Honestly, if any of these theories is correct, the high priest does have a lot of these answers are judgment calls. You know, they're not completely, you know, precise. Now we have what was decided ultimately, but we've only got four or five episodes. I mean, if they have to go in with some fairly complicated questions, and if you're looking at consonants, or goodness, if you're looking at yes and no responses, it's like, well, boy, you know, it could be this, could be that, you know, do I take the risk of asking again? Like, God, could you be clear? Or, you know, give me three of these in a row and then I'll know. You know, there's just this element of uncertainty to it.
I wonder if pagan rituals come from that, like reading the bones and witchcraft. You know, I wonder if they derive from this or,
well,
it's interesting.
I wouldn't say they derive, but there's a conceptual relationship. I mean, the Old Testament specifically forbids things like reading entrails, you know, from animals, and actually pokes fun at that. And I think part of the reason is that whole system could be sort of set up. In other words, it would have to be created by people who were how do I want to say this? Basically, the logic was you cut a liver out of this animal and based upon its, if there was discoloration, if there's any spotting, the shape of it, you sort of have to come up, and they did, with kind of like tables or like handbooks of, okay, if it's this shape, it means that. If it has three spots, it means this. The priests themselves had to create, again, the cheat sheet for the process. But you really can't get that here. You're more or less dependent on a very limited set of parameters, but even those parameters, again, you have this element of uncertainty, but you can't jimmy it. You know, again, it's not that it's perfect that you could have a corrupt priest that says, oh, it means this or that, you know, but again, that's just part of the problem of any system when revelation is in the hands of a few people. If the Lord's with them, that's one thing. If they're not, well, that's something totally different. But that still is different than, again, being able to sort of create your own system for how you are going to have it work, creating a handbook and all that sort of stuff. So there's a similarity, but there's also a difference, at least when it came to reading entrails and things like that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, it's just so, I mean, people complain today about, oh boy, I wish translations were better. Oh, you know, I wish it was more clear here. Hey, it could be a whole lot worse. You know, it could be a whole lot more ambiguous and useful for manipulating, you know, an audience.
Not if we had the magic eight ball, it'd be crystal clear. All right, Mike. Well, I think that's going to do it this week. Next week, I'm excited. We're going to do Leviticus 10. That's some good stuff in Leviticus 10. I'm interested in.
Yeah. Yeah. We get, somebody dies. So is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah, there's something violent and strange. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, all right, Mike, is there anything else you'd like to discuss for this week?
No, I don't really have anything to add as far as, you know, reminding people generally, keep looking at the events calendar and stay up with things that way, but nothing new.
Okay, well, that sounds good. I just want to thank you for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.